This session focuses much more on governance than on the sort of nitty-gritty technical issues. And Paul will follow on with the client's view, with huge thanks to our client, CETA. We've got four main themes that I'll be coming back to, which, you know, to use Laurie's analogy, are to try and sort of identify the audience and then identify the issues that the audience is going to listen to. So you've got the people context, the strategy context, the policy context, and processes for open source governance. But before that, just a very quick setting of context and perspective again. A couple of quotes. I'll read the bottom one from Gartner. Just because something's free doesn't mean it has no cost. Companies must have a policy for procuring open source, deciding which applications will be supported by it, and identifying the IP risk or supportability risk associated with it. Once the policy is in place, there must be a governance process to enforce it. So this, as Laurie again has said, this sort of takes it outside the kind of legal group and plonks it firmly in the group that has oversight of governance and related issues. Legal has a role, and in our experience, and we'll see when Paul comes on to talk about the CETA experience, legal acts as midwife to that process. Some recent surveys on the slide here. The second one, which is the Black Duck recent survey at the end of last year, 20% of code base of the average product or application is now open source. And the cost of that open source, that 20%, is estimated at around $25 million per product or app. So this, again, puts the economic context up there. This stuff saves time, it saves money. But again, in order to get that benefit, the responsibility needs to be around proper use within the organization. Next slide is just a very fleeting canter through the current open source license top 20. Again, this is a website maintained by Black Duck, and it's there for everyone to see. There's a link to it in the materials on the CD in your pack. Overwhelmingly, GPL2, which is Article 2B, has the sort of poster child issue for open source copyleft, still accounts for about half the licenses out there. The four FSF licenses, the two GPL versions 2 and 3, and the two lesser GPL versions 2.1 and 3, account for almost two-thirds of the open source licenses out there. This is pretty stable over time. The bottom 10 account for less than 7% of the total licenses. So when you're looking at the more permissive licenses that Laurie mentioned briefly, the BSD, MIT, they're around 10%, the liberal licenses. But the overwhelming feature here is that GPL2 accounts for pretty much half of licenses out there. One thing I should perhaps say is that another useful way of visualizing this is, you know, software is software. Whether it's open source, mixed, proprietary, closed, whatever, it's still lumps of code. Open source is the licensing technique associated with that software. So it's all about, open source is all about the licenses. It's not really so much about the code. The main point on the cases is, in terms of update, is that there is still no authoritative case law on the key GPL issues. What constitutes distribution, what the extent of copyleft, the international aspects on when you would be litigating in the UK a contract which might be subject to US law, the status of the FSF, FAQs, and the remedies that are available. There's still no authoritative case law, which sort of bedevils conventional legal analysis in this area. I mentioned Jacobson and Katzer and Commind. That was settled in February. FSF, the Free Software Foundation, and Cisco points the way to the future. That was a settlement, again, after litigation, where it was a requirement of the settlement that Cisco should appoint an open source compliance officer, prepare ongoing compliance reports. This case arose out of an acquisition by Cisco in the early 2000s of another company. So the quick update is that there's still not that much there. A very quick reprise on copyleft. Article 2B, as I say, is the poster child. There is a general consensus emerging that Article 2B is enforceable in principle. This is the enshrines the principle of heredity, where your software, let's call that Program A, contains or becomes derived from or a work based on, to use the language of the GPL, the GPL code Program B, when does your software become tainted or acquire or inherit the requirement to license out under GPL 2B. So the key issues are just when does your program that you'd like to keep proprietary because it confers competitive advantage, say, when does your program A contain or become derived from or become a work based on the GPL code? This takes you into the linking debate, how the two software elements work together, whether it's through linking statically or dynamically, whether it's through system calls, plugs and sockets. The FSF has a European legal network, which I'm sure many of you will belong to, which is trying to come up with some guidance, which is now, I understand, in its final stages, on the types of connection, the types of correlation between yours and the GPL code that will bring into play Article 2B. Article 2B is only relevant when software is distributed. Now, just when is software distributed? Do you have to pass on a copy of the code outside the organisation? What happens when you make it available to your contractors? Individual, corporate, you may outsource development. Does that make any difference? So a whole load of issues are yet undecided. And the debate centres on sort of classic, mainly US copyright law analytical techniques. The GPL calls down, it draws in US copyright law principles. The Free Software Foundation has, I'm sure many of you will have been there on the website, a very extensive list of FAQs. What is their legal status? Are they self-serving? Can they be relied on? And you have emerging accepted software development practice with Linux and Java. But it's very much the case that these are novel legal concepts. There is an absence of any helpful case law. And those are two of the things that contribute to a traditional legal analysis, this sort of forensic legal analysis, the analysis that Mr. Justice Ramsey went through in B Sky B and EDS on entire agreements and representations. This analysis we sort of can't really apply in the open source world. The legal concepts are novel, there's an absence of case law. The technical analysis is always, the more you go, it's a bit of a melancholy experience in a way, the more you go into it, the more complex it gets. And you're looking at particular lines of code and how they call down and work with other lines of code in a code base that may be tens of millions of lines, and I'm sure in some of the BAE systems will be billions and billions of lines of code. The way that cases happen is different. You don't get a letter before action. You get a sort of murmuring among the grasslands in the eco-community of the open source world. And that sort of depends, as we'll see, on what kind of company you are. So the sort of granular legal analysis that we're used to is not a good response to OSS. There has to be another way of doing it. The legal sort of analytical techniques are cost inefficient. And this again points the way to governance. So there's a good quote from Forrester's report in spring last year. Regardless of how you view adoption of open source, whether it's desirable or inevitable, the first step in moving from a tactical mess to a strategic plan is to specify the conditions under which OSS is permissible in your shop. By creating a concise policy, re-engineering the software acquisition process, and adding control points to lifecycle management processes, applications development professionals can shift from a tactical response to conscious integration based on realistic expectations and articulated economic benefits. And that really underpins the move to governance which, when we look at it, as Laurie has said in the case of BAE, and within the businesses within BAE, there's no one size fits all. It's all what's appropriate to your business. And the range of organizations is large. They'll be different if it's public sector and if it's private sector. If open source is only used internally, there'll be one set of responses. If it's used in the products that you distribute, there'll be another set. As we see when we move into the hosted space, ASP, SaaS, cloud, a different set of issues. OSS is much more visible in a business-to-consumer organization, and it's no surprise that a number of the sort of cases that the FSF has been interested in arise in things that the end-user consumer is using at home. Product spread, geographical spread are also relevant. So no one size fits all, but what we've tried to do here is to work towards a practical sort of analytical framework, if you like, for getting there. Just worth reminding very quickly what the objectives and principles are of governance for open source. Similar to other IP-based policies and governance, reducing and managing risk and maximizing reward. So this is making sure that you've got the benefits in place, but also the responsibilities for them. You'll want to avoid disputes. You'll want to achieve good management and housekeeping for a financial event, ensure customer satisfaction, and be a good corporate citizen. And no surprises here. So far as OSS is concerned, the key principles are supporting these objectives are, you know what stuff or open source your organization is using. Know where it's coming from so that you can source it reliably. Know what that open source does and where it's being used and reused. Track it properly. Know who is responsible for what in relation to open source, what their responsibility and authority levels are. And you know, as I mentioned, open source is a licensing technique. Know that your organization is complying with its OSS license obligations. The way we've approached governance from a number of sort of client projects that we've been working on is to try and build up a comprehensive, analytical, and above all, practical framework. The start point is always your open source achievements to date. You'll be looking at governance, you won't be looking at it in a vacuum, you will be using open source at the moment, and that's always the start point. And there are these four threads that I'd like to go through in a little bit more detail: the people context, the strategy context, policy, and process. I won't go through this slide in a lot of detail, it's in the materials, but there are a large number of stakeholders in even mid-sized organizations for whom open source is relevant. And for each of them, you need to see what their prime open source objective is and how that objective is achieved. There's a role here for legal, to minimize legal risks and maximize benefits to the organization in its contractual commitments, the license agreements and OSS governance, and helping other stakeholders to manage OSS governance with particular emphasis on documents, statements, contracts, and so on. In our experience, it's important that ownership of open source governance lies with the people that are using it. We'll see when we come on to CETA that it's for developers, by developers. But the legal group acts as a sort of midwife to the process, moving particularly from this tactical mess, in the words of Forrester, to a more analytical process. So a number of stakeholder groups, make sure that you get them all involved. The strategy context, and here is just a sort of template strategy statement. Again, I won't go through it in a lot of detail, but it starts off from, again, these are kind of home truths. The organization fully recognizes and respects the rights of and its agreements with others, just as it expects them to perform their agreements with us. So accordingly, we respect the need to ensure compliance with our legal obligations. Open source governance within the organization and achieving the right balance. Again, we'll go into this in a little bit more detail with the CETA example, but what do you want to achieve in your use of open source? You want to attract the best talent, you want to increase competitiveness, you want to add value to stakeholders, you want to support the development community, You want to communicate effectively. You want to take into account the interests of the stakeholders. And very often you end up in this mixed software environment where open source is used in conjunction with proprietary software. Using open source and proprietary software, both owned by the organization and third parties, you're constantly evaluating where open source is best used. That open source strategy will need to be sort of aligned to particularly other IP strategies that the organization may have. And again, this takes you into the sort of role of higher level compliance. Once you've got the strategy established and top management, aided by legal, has a role for sort of intermediating and mediating between all the interests of the various groups, you then have the policy statement. You know, what's its purpose? Who does it apply to? What's its status? And it's important that if you have a policy for, like, for open source, that you may want to give it sort of some HR status, like other policies that you have, perhaps an IT or an email policy. What's the authorization process? Who can say whether we can use this open source or not? This rapidly comes down to people, roles, responsibilities, training and awareness. In the cases that we've been involved with, it's useful to have two sort of levels of open source oversight. One is the working party, an open source working party, which is linked perhaps in a software development company or in the software development area to architects, software architecture review bodies of other groups. That has oversight of the open source software compliance officer. A little bit perhaps like a data protection compliance officer. This is the individual that's charged with first line of support reporting to at the open source working party. As Laurie mentioned, I can't emphasize enough that training and awareness is so important here. There needs to be regular and frequent training about the licenses that the companies can use, the products that are able to be used, general and specific, by the compliance officer and the working party. If you need to make sure that the strategy and policy are understood and met. The policy itself, you need to look at this probably in three areas. For inbound transactions, which sort of links in very much to procurement, what's the approach to, you know, pre-contract approach to RFIs, RFPs, the approach in the contracts themselves. Your classical procurement contract warranties and indemnities typically might not address all the open source issues that you need to address. So do you need a specific set of OSS language in your inbound development agreements? In the M&A world, again, where this is very live, you'll probably need to have some sort of way for a trusted third party, perhaps to evaluate the open source of the target that you're acquiring. So that's inbound. In in-house development, you know, what's the authorization mechanism? There should be an easily accessible statement of approved open source software, approved open source licenses, and typically, as we'll see, you get onto this through a code indicator tool, which sort of takes the human intervention out very often. There needs to be a specific and easy to use for the development community. And I've got going through my mind the picture of the mad scientists and the nerd, but the developers need to have something that they feel helps them. If it doesn't, it won't work. And again, on outbound transactions, we're seeing much more comeback for our supplier clients, where customers are saying, you know, we're going to need you to be a lot more specific about open source. So what's the approach to that? Again, what are the approval levels, and what's the involvement of legal? Again, do you want to push this over to the open source working party? And finally, on this generic level, before we pass over to the CETA experience, just the process context. And the main thing here is that you don't want a bunch of individuals to be constantly associating licenses with the open source and then giving their analysis. There's got to be a better way of doing it. And this takes you into code indicator tools, which can be very costly. And again, where the rubber hits the road on this is the benefit of using open source and how you manage those responsibilities, particularly are you going to use Fossology, Palomide, Black Duck, one of the code indicator tools. It's always good to have in mind the dependencies with the processes that you're putting in place with the other patents, you know, patent policy, IP policies, the groups overseeing product architecture and strategic direction, source code management. Know where your code comes from means that if you're using a source code management tool like Subvert, perhaps you should run the two together, or at least make sure that you know that the one is talking to the other. We've already briefly mentioned HR policies. Coming on to implementing your open source governance policies, this needs to be treated, if you're setting one up, like any other major development project. So it needs to be planned, it needs to be mapped, there needs to be timing. You need to procure and implement your indicator tool. This can run into sort of, you know, six figures very quickly. You need to take your initial code assessment. You need to consider perhaps some sort of amnesty for the development community. They'll come to this thinking, I've been doing this and I don't know whether I should have been doing this or not, so how do you get them to buy into it? Communication's really important, but perhaps having a period of time in which they can come to you and sort of fess up and say what they've been doing. And then consider a pilot project implementation. Take, I don't know, 10% of the code base, some really easily separable development project, and use that to start with. In terms of implementation, what we found works is to sort of take the top X, 15, 20 licenses in use in the company and have an accessible, sort of developer-friendly list of do's and don'ts. A sort of whitelist, which you can go away and use, available on the intranet for open source components approved and open source licenses approved. Similarly, you may have a blacklist saying, you know, this stuff can't be used, and you may have a grey list, which is this stuff can only be used if you get explicit approval. You need to sort of link that into pre-launch and release compliance. And then probably as part of this, you need to have accepted response times and service levels from your open source working party and compliance officers. So post-implementation, this stuff goes on when you've got the system working. Again, training and awareness is probably the most important thing here. You'll need to have a code and information repository. If you can tie that into your source code development management, source code management, that will be useful. You need to have periodical code assessments. And then, as we've mentioned briefly, remediation arrangements. It's really no good doing this without having given some forethought to what happens if you think you've got a problem. If you have a potential Article 2B issue where you're distributing code that may be based on or working with GPL code in a way that you'd rather not, how do you put it right? And you need to come at the whole process thinking, you know, okay, so we've found out these problems, what are we going to do with it to put it right? So that's really just a very quick canter through what we found to be helpful, these four building blocks: people, strategy, policy, and process. And now to see how a client, CETA, has done this, and with huge thanks to Tuli Day, I'll pass over to Paul.
Thanks, Richard. Why is there not up here to give CETA's little pitch as to how their world looks? They are the world's leading specialists in air transport communications and IT solutions, as you can see, responsible for delivering and managing business solutions for airline, airport, GDS, and other customers over the world, over the world's most extensive network, which forms the communications backbone of the global air transport industry. They are partly responsible for helping airplanes stay in the air. They've got 550 members, just over 3,000 customers in over 200 countries, 4,500 employees from over 140 nationalities, speaking over 70 different languages, and $1.5 billion of revenue. So perhaps not quite such a diverse product line as BAE, but certainly a very big business with a lot of different issues. And I've got the privilege just to share with you a presentation that was given by CETA Legal to one of their development teams just a few weeks ago about open source governance and the pilot program that they were running. We thought this would be really useful to share with you just as an example of open source governance actually in action in a global organization. You may have seen it in your own, but this is quite interesting. We won't go through all the slides in detail. I just want to give you a flavor really of what they were talking about. So here's the list of the issues that were on their agenda. The usual, why should people be concerned about open source, down to some quite specific details about their pilot project that they were running. So they were explaining to the development team, giving some more background about what open source was, setting out the criteria as to what would and wouldn't be considered a piece of open source software. And also just highlighting that they, bring it all up, just how widespread it is, the huge abundance. I mean, this wouldn't have been shock to any of the developers in the room who would be busy using most of this. Sorry, these are coming up a little bit. Sorry. So, and just reiterating really why people should be concerned. I can't go past this without just highlighting to you all the fact that Eric Raymond uses the word, if it is a word, highfalutin. And I'd encourage you all to go away and use it as much as you possibly can over the next few days, perhaps with each other, I don't know. So, here goes. So flagging up, and Richard mentioned some of these before, but obviously it is useful to be aware of some of the other issues that have hit the market over the last few years in relation to open source. Lots of settlements, but have required the party that was allegedly in breach to offer up some pretty big commitments to get rid of the problem. So CETA were wanting to make sure that everyone was aware of that. And here, just really setting out, perhaps quite tellingly, the fact that when you're thinking about using third-party open source software, lots of the considerations are very similar to the sort of things that you would be thinking about when you are using proprietary software. And really, the sort of care that you would take when you're using third-party proprietary software should be considered at the same time as when you're using open source. I mean, this really resonates with Laura's comments about the fact that this is a deal. You're still entering into a contract, and you have certain responsibilities and obligations as a result of using the software. So looking really about where CETA had got to at the point of this presentation, in relation to open source governance, they ran a lot of developer workshops, series of workshops, just to really have a look at what was going on at the time, and unsurprisingly came to the conclusion that open source was in widespread use in the development community. There was a high level of awareness of the risks of modifying open source. The developers were aware that this was an issue that they needed to be alive to. They were less aware of the risks associated with the distribution of the code, particularly when it was wrapped up with some proprietary code and how that in itself created some problems. They also, one of the other outputs of the workshops was that it was now being raised as a major corporate risk. This had reached board level. This was part of a big issue for the company. They'd gone on to appoint an OSCO, an open source compliance officer, similar to the lines that Richard mentioned before, and started to develop some processes and training and oversight of the way that open source was used by developers at CETA. And they'd also approved the purchase of one of the scanning tools that Richard mentioned, the one that's offered by Black Duck, and had started this pilot. So they certainly weren't starting from a standing start. They'd made some steps, and I would have thought this would be fairly similar across a lot of global businesses. Things had got underway, and there was some awareness. So at this point, they'd set up this pilot project as a way of really just sort of taking it another step further and trying to spread awareness within the organization and to see what the reaction would be to something a bit more formal. They had the Black Duck tool, and what they were planning on doing was taking a small amount of the code base within from a number of discrete product lines and running a scan of those of that code base to see how much open source was being used in it and whether the license terms were being complied with. And that the idea was to follow that with the future program going forward of establishing a much broader global-wide strategy, policy, and process, so much along the lines that Richard talked about before. So they acquired the tool from Black Duck. For those of you that aren't familiar with it, it's basically a lookup table that compares the code in your software with what's on their database and highlights where the code is obviously an open source code, and also indicates what licenses that open source code has been distributed under. So how was the pilot going at that point? They'd established the open source working party. They'd also drafted and had approved some strategy and policy documents, which we'll talk about in a minute, and also some procedures and license guidelines had also been drafted. And all of this is trying to get to a point where the whole thing becomes quite integrated into the working lives of the developers. They're aware of it, they have a policy and a process, and they know how to run it themselves without continually going back to the legal team. And then they'd identified 16 product lines, and they'd been busy scanning through those, and they were being reviewed. Now we mentioned strategy a few times. Here is what Tosita looks like, their strategic goals. And they are license compliance, so really just making sure that they actually comply with the licenses that they are for the open source that they're using. Development and efficiency, provision of open source oversight, training, and really making sure that they have a good repository of all the open source information. Improving open source skills within the business, and then using open source for all the benefits that it brings, enabling faster time to market, reducing the costs, increasing the competitiveness, and increasing shareholder value. And at the heart of the project, what they were trying to do was to build some guidance for developers. So developers could take some open source code, identify what license it was licensed under or distributed under, and understand what it was that they could or couldn't do with it. So coming up with some terms and making sure that those were understood within the business. And then building this much more detailed guideline summary, which basically goes through on the far left all the different open source licenses that they'd identified as being most prevalent within the business, and splitting it up here between usage that in relation to hosted applications, or internal use, and then hosted applications, and then that software that's been distributed, and trying to map out the different obligations that they would need to comply with for each. So hopefully quite a quick sort of lookup table for use. I mentioned the scanning process that they were going through. So they took the code, they scanned it into Black Duck, and ran basically an assessment of what open source was being used, with the results being put to a project team for review, and then to try and agree some remedial action, and also the efforts that need to be remedial efforts that need to be followed up on following the results of the scan. So really, you know, here was their interim findings, where they got to so far, basically what they discovered was, unsurprisingly, there was quite a lot of open source being used within the business, not being distributed, which was obviously useful. Some issues in relation to copyright notices, which could be remedied. Interestingly, this process also flagged up quite a few, some proprietary license breaches as well, which they could remedy at the same time, and really highlighting some of the remedial action that was necessary and was going to be undertaken in relation to those product lines which had been subjected to the pilot review. And the idea is to build all those results into, again, another table. Down the left-hand side is the different product areas which were reviewed, really showing how much code, the size of the files, and how much code had been reviewed, and the results, and how it all mapped out, having done the analysis. So here's what's next on their agenda. They got to complete the rest of the scanning and the reviews, and then really have an assessment of open source usage based on those results. Look at the remedial action that is required. Review the open source risk as well. Provide a report for the pilot, and then submit a business case for entity-wide open source governance. And this slide, which is in your pack, is Thule at CETA provided us with some sort of thoughts that she'd had after having gone through this experience of the pilot. I think these are really worth running through. These are the things that she, having gone through it all and looking back, really stood out for her. So the first is the buy-in of key stakeholders is essential, and both Richard and Laurie have touched on that as well. And it's really important that the main concepts are communicated to the decision makers. So things like that this is a governance process for developers by developers. It's something that needs to be owned by them rather than being run by legal. And it's important that the governance is viewed as something which allows you to understand your code base. And it's only the unmanaged risk, the unmanaged use of open source that is a risk. And she was really in favor of doing a pilot, really starting somewhere quite small and manageable and running through the process so everyone gets used to it and understands the fact that the process is possible and eases those fears of costs. Awareness raising didn't prove as useful as everyone thought it was going to be. That sort of distribution of fear amongst everybody that this whole thing is going to be cause everything to collapse wasn't very helpful in moving things forward. What was more useful was making people understand that it would free up developer time, it would give them a better knowledge of how to use open source, which was really an area of confusion, and mainly through the guidance on specific licenses, so positives rather than negatives. Just reinforcing also that the internal risk assessment was carried out by corporate risk. This was a matter for the company as a whole, not a discrete odd bit of the business. This is now something that needs to be on the corporate risk register and dealt with properly. And legal's involvement really was although they're going to be on the open source steering group, but their main job was to provide tools and awareness to the key users in the development team to equip them to handle the broad issues that the whole thing throws up. And finally, reinforcing things that have been said before, training is really important. Continuing to educate the business and make it realize that this was all manageable, but there were specific things that needed to be complied with. And finally, it was being viewed as a good thing in raising the company's profile as a user, a good corporate citizen of open source in customer communications.